Welcome to I Hate James Dobson, a podcast that does not advocate for child abuse.
That's true.
I like these. I think we should have a different one every week.
I agree.
Hi, I'm Jake. I'm a marriage and family therapist. Joining me is my amazing colleague and co-host, Brooke. Hi, Brooke.
Hi, Jake.
Brooke, you're also a therapist.
Yeah.
Nice. How are you doing?
Great. Doing great. Excited to learn a little bit more about our buddy James Dobson.
Your boy, JD. So last time, we went through a journey through the tragically ongoing life of James Dobson, founder of evangelical media behemoth Focus on the Family. We trace his journey from being a marriage counselor working under famed eugenicist to a member of the American Psychological Association to being a spiritual advisor to every Republican president since and including Reagan. Dobson has ties to everyone, the Supreme Court justices, the Duggars, Ted fucking Bundy. Dobson's reach is so wide, he's probably the reason that you were spanked as a kid. Brooke, what do you remember about our journey through Dobson last time?
Well, I remember learning about Focus on the Family, or as I like to call it,
Five.
And I remember that the Duggars were involved, as well, it wasn't surprising. Mm-hmm. Really. I remember learning that I was spanked because of James Dobson, which was unsettling for the last several weeks since we recorded, and most of the rest of it. Oh, and Ted Bundy.
Ted Bundy.
And then honestly, Jake, the rest of it I've just kind of blocked out and tried to repress.
I've spent a lifetime in trying to do the same, so I get it. How do you feel about James Dobson?
Yucky and gross.
What are the vibes?
The vibes are not great.
Not great.
No, the vibes are way off.
So today I want to dig into the works of Jimmy Dobbs and give them the scrutiny they are long overdue for. In doing my research for this podcast, I found many people who are critical of Dobson because he's a fucking moron. But I found that many of them were outsiders, people who were rightly focused on the more outrageous bits, like railing against condom promoters and the homosexual agenda, that they missed the more subtle but devastating bits. They missed the top notes of bullshit. The coded language of evangelicalism and all of its slipperiness tends to invade those for whom it is not their natural tongue. Thankfully, I'm very good with my tongue.
So I've heard.
Oh, you see my name on the bathroom stall? If you grew up evangelical, this podcast is to tell you that no, you're not crazy, and yes, the things that you think were bad were absolutely bad. If you didn't grow up as an evangelical, this podcast is here to show you that really, you kind of did. And if you are an evangelical, hey!
Welcome.
Welcome. Glad you're here.
Cool. You might have some questions.
Yeah, I don't know what you're going to get out of this, but I'm kind of mean to this guy and his dumbass beliefs, but you're welcome to hang around if you want.
And maybe stick around.
Yeah, you might learn a thing.
And also, we can help you find a therapist.
Today, we're going to talk about Dobson's first and arguably most well-known book.
Oh, wait, don't tell me the title. Okay, because I don't know the titles, but I know that they're all secretly kind of dirty. Is this one called Spank Me, Daddy?
Oh, honestly, the world would be a better place if it was. No.
Discipline for All? Is that it?
Getting closer.
Okay.
I'm not going to give you the name yet.
Okay.
He released three versions of this throughout the years, and it's actually a really fascinating snapshot of his evolution throughout his skid mark of a career. He released one in the 70s, at the start of his career, one in the 90s, and one in the 2010s. Let's start at the very beginning.
Okay.
It's 1971. America feels like it's exploding into the modern era. President Johnson had created Medicare, and Nixon was in his second year as president. Stonewall had just rioted. Buzz, Neil, and Stanley made a cute little movie about the moon. The hippies are high off of Woodstock and LSD. The FBI had killed MLK, and America was in Vietnam for reasons that we still don't really understand.
Yeah, don't ask questions. Yeah.
The idyllic white America of the 1950s is dead. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll are running rampant. Gasoline still has lead in it, and the kids are not all right. In this dust devil of chaos arrives a manifesto, a creed, a doctrine of stability, and is delivered to us poor and huddled masses. I am talking about motherfucking Dare to Discipline.
Dare to Discipline. That's what it is. And every time you say it, we're going to go. Or I'm going to go, ow!
So it's important to know at the start of this that Dobson is writing this as a clinician. Okay. Mostly. Like, it is not an academic text, but he is a practicing clinician. He's a member of the American Psychological Association at this point. He's working actively in medicine and hospitals and teaching and stuff. So he's involved in the state of psychology in the 1970s. And the state of psychology in the 1970s is bad.
Yeah, it's a free-for-all.
It is just trash.
Uh-huh.
A little bit about psychology in the 1970s. Behaviorism is pretty big, which is just we can understand people's psychology through watching what they do. You get a lot of ideas of like conditioning, how to train a dog, operant conditioning, classical conditioning. Classical conditioning is like you ring a bell and dog starts salivating.
Uh-huh.
Pavlov. Pavlov, yeah. Postmodernism was just beginning to enter the scene of psychology. Postmodernism is really questioning the assumptions that people had gone into for you. People meaning white therapists and psychologists, because that's who it was. So the ideas of what creates, what healthy means is being questioned. The idea of what a family means is being questioned. That's what postmodernism is. And it has been a thorn in the side of evangelicals ever since. At this point, homosexuality was still a mental disorder in the DSM. And applying to psychology to education, which is what Dobson is doing in this book, was actually really controversial. And infusing it with religious beliefs was considered blasphemous to a lot of people. In doing the research for this, I found a lot of people who were criticizing Dobson were other evangelicals.
Mm.
And they do a better job critiquing him than a lot of the people that I've seen around today, like other therapists and psychologists and media people.
Interesting. Yeah. And podcasters.
And podcasters. A number of podcasters. Shout out to Behind the Bastards. So I have two physical copies of these books here, and we're going to have a grand old time with them. And we're going to go just chapter by chapter. This is basically my book report of why this book sucks.
Incredible.
And we're going to start with the foreword, an introduction. The foreword is written by a guy named Paul Popenoe.
Oh, I remember hearing about Popenoe.
Mm-hmm. Paul Popenoe was Dobson's mentor. Dobson worked for this guy. Paul Popenoe was considered the founder of family counseling, marriage counseling in the United States. And he was a eugenicist.
Perfect.
Very explicitly and clearly and proudly a eugenicist. In family therapy, he counseled people away from interracial marriages.
Oh, Paul.
Yeah. This foreword, though, has a noted absence of eugenics, at least explicitly. It's pretty milquetoast. It's pretty okay. But it ends with this phrase, and I think this is a good thesis statement for this book. Love is not enough, and discipline is not punishment. This is how they're framing it. So the whole idea of this book of parenting is, yes, you need to love your child, but just loving them is not enough. You need to discipline them. And there's a difference between discipline, which is good, and punishment, which is bad.
Wow.
Yeah.
Love is not enough, and discipline is not punishment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to put that in my wedding vows.
It's a punishment if you can ask for it. It also, I think it's a good thesis statement because it's also just garbage and bullshit.
Yeah.
Discipline is not punishment is a fake separation of terms that, especially when you get into what it actually looks like, they're the same thing. And any distinction to like say this is good and this is bad just isn't real. It's just plausible deniability here. And then we get into the introduction. And this is written by Dobson. This is the first words that Dobson writes. And it starts with a parable. Dobson's writing feels very much like a bad preacher speaks. There's a lot of stories that he will tell, and it's impossible to tell if they're real stories, if they're based on real events, if he's just kind of bullshitting. He says them all with the same certainty and clarity and authority. It's impossible to tell. To me, they feel like parables, and I'm going to keep calling them parables.
Great.
This parable is about a woman that comes into his office for parenting advice, who has a 3-year-old child who he refers to as a tyrant and a dictator.
Dobson refers to the 3-year-old child as a tyrant and a dictator.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And the mom here had tried everything except for spanking. This mom had tried everything.
Yes.
And one of the things that this mom had done is reflecting back the kid's feelings. So the kid was upset that, like, the mom didn't bring a glass of water soon enough. And the mom was like, hey, you were upset because they didn't bring you this glass of water.
Right.
Dobson says that, reflecting back a kid's feelings, is, quote, teaching a child that differences between parent and child were to be perceived as differences in viewpoint.
Whoa.
So it's a whole, like, straw man argument misrepresenting what it is and then saying, well, this is clearly stupid.
Yes.
We're not trying to control behavior by reflecting back kids' feelings. We're trying to teach them what their feelings are.
Right.
You're just talking about the wrong thing here. He calls this permissive parenting, which is basically a catch-all for anyone not willing to spank their child.
Yeah, we call it communication.
Communication. Permissiveness. This is a quote from Dobson. When I use the term permissiveness, I refer to the absence of effective parental authority, resulting in the lack of boundaries for the child. This word represents a tolerance of childish disrespect, defiance, and general confusion that occurs in the absence of adult leadership.
I love the idea that a three-year-old is being disrespectful, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, a three-year-old.
Dobson does this, like, adultification of kids.
Yes.
He assumes a lot of motives of them that just aren't how kids think.
Right.
We're going to get into it a little bit, but when he sees kids acting out, he believes that they know full well what they are doing and are choosing to be disrespectful little shits.
I mean, I kind of get it. Sometimes I feel that way about three-year-olds, too. But
sure.
It's not the truth.
No. And sometimes kids are shits on purpose, because everyone's a shit on purpose sometimes. But, yeah. Like, Dobson does not approach it in a way that is healthy or productive.
Yeah.
This is often how Dobson's arguments go. He presents some anecdotal, apocryphal parable to create a distorted view of a somewhat real position, and then responds back with an oversimplistic and euphemistic rebuttal. Reflecting back at kids' feelings, which is a good thing that parents should do, becomes ignoring the challenge to your parental authority, and that the way to set this hierarchy is with discipline, which he now narrowly defines as hitting your kid. So it's an obfuscation of what's really being said, and then a euphemism of what he's saying.
Wow.
The language here is really slippery. Just reading the plain text of the book, I found myself a lot of times being like, yeah, I agree with that. Kids need structure. What I mean when I say kids need structure is very different from what Dobson is saying when he says kids need structure. But he doesn't get into it in a lot of explicit detail, does not always lay out what that structure means. And therefore, people of good faith will say, oh, he's pretty reasonable. But people who know actually know what he's saying, what he's talking about.
Yeah, and this is something that happens everywhere, right? Which is like using therapy language, right? In this really tricky way. Like, children need boundaries, and that's the word, right? But it's not spankings.
Mm-hmm. Mm. In this case, when Dobson says kids need discipline, he very clearly means hitting your kid. But there's just enough wiggle room in this one introduction that he didn't say you need to spank your kid. He just says we need to discipline more. It also features some unearned and unethical confidence at the very end. Quote, the recommendations in this manuscript are not experimental or speculative. They represent an approach to child management which can be trusted. They're not based on abstruse theoretical assumptions, but rather on practical consequences. As Jack London has stated, the best measure of anything should be, does it work? When properly applied, discipline works. Therapists cannot make all or nothing claims like that.
No.
It is like ethics 101. It was literally a question like this was literally on my licensing test about are you misrepresenting yourself? You can say discipline is shown to be really effective, or this thing, like, you can say this works generally, but you cannot say it always works 100% of the time, because it doesn't. And also, through Dobson's logic, if it's not working, then you're not doing it right. You're not disciplining someone correctly. It's all about power, structure, and control. Those are the three kind of defining terms of Dobson's worldview and of this book.
Yeah. And very tricky language.
Very slippery language, yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And that idea, which I think is pervasive in a lot of religious text, of like, if it's not working, it's your fault.
There's a lot of blame on the parents. Dobson later will talk about being gay as the parents' fault. If your son is gay, it's because you were a bad father in some way.
Oh.
Like, a lot of the world needs to work a certain way. If it's not that, it is your fault. A lot of, like, individualization going on.
He's creating so much potential for resentment between parents and children. It's really interesting. Like, even that, what we were just talking about, that idea of, like, adultifying children, right? And then creating real resentment between parents and children, right?
So I grew up evangelical. There's a kind of social, I don't know that movement's exactly the right word, but like social identity called ex-evangelical, people who grew up evangelical and have deconstructed since then. And a lot of it is kids who are raised evangelical. And a lot of them are very angry, and there's a lot of resentment there because of stuff like this. So chapter 1 of Dobson's book is called Teaching Respect and Responsibility to Children.
Mm.
I've labeled it How James Dobson Views the World, or The Importance of Parenting in the Culture War. Let's talk about Dobson's beliefs. We talked a little bit about this last time, but let's really get into it. Dobson is a structuralist. He believes in structure. He believes that society needs hierarchy, specifically a white Christian capitalist patriarchy.
Right.
This is the foundation of the culture war. Anything that goes against that hierarchy is bad. We see that today still. Anything from trans rights to abortion to fucking food stamps, all of these things are culture war issues because they go against this hierarchy. Dobson, though, as an evangelical, believes that this is God's natural design. This hierarchy is the only way that things will work. The hierarchy is essential to a functioning society. And also, this hierarchy is reproduced throughout society to differing scales. The nuclear family, capitalism, a classroom, slavery are all different manifestations of the same hierarchy. And they're all deeply intertwined. Families make up classes and churches, which make up a nation. In that frame, the nuclear family is the base of this hierarchy. Without it, it all falls apart. And that's why it is so important for Dobson to focus on the family. As opposed to FNAF, which is much more fun and also much less damaging to children. Society, according to Dobson, hasn't been enforcing this hierarchy because they're woke. And that's why everything is bad now.
Make America great again.
Quite literally, yes. This is the seeds of fascism. Mm. Permissive parenting, the civil rights movement, and sexual liberation all seek to undermine God's prescribed hierarchy. Dobson says, quote, "The mid-century decade has been described as the most permissive 10 years in our history. Is it merely coincidental that the generation raised during this era has grown up to challenge every form of authority that it confronts? I think not. The problems we face today have not resulted from the existence of the H-bomb, or from restrictions of free speech, or from poverty, or from racial injustice. No, the central cause of turmoil among the young is we've demanded neither respect nor responsible behavior from our children."
Wow.
There is no systemic problems.
No.
There's no systemic racism. This hierarchy is correct and ordained by God. If there is problems, it is individual and it is parenting based.
Even just the phrase demanding respect. Like, not earning.
Yeah.
Demanding respect.
The way that a lot of evangelical, especially evangelical homeschools, will talk about how to raise kids is the purpose of teaching kids is to teach them obedience. Mm. Whereas what we know through research and also just being a decent human being is that the purpose of teaching kids is to prepare them to be an adult in the world.
Right.
To teach them about their emotions, about other people, to give them the skills to survive in a cruel, uncaring universe.
Mm-hmm.
That is not what Dobson believes. He believes we need to teach them obedience.
Right, so that we can keep the structure and the hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we are inherently rebellious against the structure, according to Dobson, because of sin, and we have to be taught good values. Heredity does not equip a child with proper attitudes. Children will learn what they are taught. So parents have to teach kids good values, and kids don't want to do them. And so you need to reinforce those good values through discipline. Because he believes in the idea of original sin and that we're all inherently sinful, it also means he talks a lot of shit about kids. And this was the quote I was talking about earlier. He says, quote, "I think most children are rather analytical about their defiance of adult authority. They consider the deed in advance, weighing its probable consequences."
Like, oh my God.
That's literally not how kids' brains work.
No, that is just not even at all how kids' brains work.
Your prefrontal cortex, the part of your brain about decision-making and long-term consequence weighing, is the last part of your brain to develop when you're in your 20s.
Yeah.
That's why teenagers make terrible decisions.
Right.
If teenagers make bad decisions because they're three-year-olds are not weighing out the consequences of their behaviors in this way.
No, they're like all impulse.
Yes.
There is no thinking. There is no premeditated action.
Yeah.
And certainly not for something as nuanced as, like, challenging authority.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's through this, like, adultification, it's through this, like, assumption of weird motives that room for child abuse, which is really what he's advocating for,
right,
gets to seem more reasonable. If kids are doing things just to defy your authority, well, they know what they're doing and they deserve a punishment. If they are just acting out of impulse because they're 3 years old and their brains are still they don't have motor control, let alone planning, punishment starts to seem a lot less acceptable.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's also been proven, I want everyone to know, that, like, reward works about 1,000 times better better than punishment. Punishment in small children especially, really, it doesn't work at all.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about some studies in just a second about that. So we have his idea of structure and hierarchy and why it's so important. Literally, he believes that this is the only hierarchy that will work.
Mm-hmm.
The other part is, how do we learn? It's important to teach kids. How do we teach kids? And really, his ideas come down to operant conditioning, which is the next chapter. We'll get into that in just a second. Basically, it just means rewards and punishments. You need to reward good behavior and punish bad behavior. Society has been too lax on punishment, permissive parenting, so no one is enforcing the hierarchy. And according to Dobson, real punishment must include physical pain.
Wow.
Must. I have a couple choice quotes here. Minor pain can be an excellent motivation for the child. The parent should have some means of making the child want to cooperate other than simply obeying because he was told to do so. And then he gives very specific advice about how to inflict pain onto your kid that's not spanking. I'm not going to get into it here because it feels like malpractice for me to give advice on how to hurt people in this podcast, but he gets into it. He gives very specific, like, atomical advice. Yeah.
I have a therapist brain question to ask about James Dobson. Do we know anything about his childhood?
Yes.
Are we going to get into that?
I didn't write a whole lot about it. His mom beat him.
Well, there we go.
And
that's what I was wondering.
He thanks her a lot for it.
Mm-hmm.
There's an anecdote that he talks about where his mom threw a girdle at him. And it caused a lot of pain, and he learned to never do whatever he was doing again, and therefore it works.
Yeah. All right. This all tracks now.
I think he's writing to both of us in this next part. There'll be those among my readers who feel that the deliberate, premeditated application of minor pain to a sweet little child is a harsh and unloving recommendation.
Correct.
Yes. Consider the alternatives. And here we're getting into the straw manning. On one hand, there's a constant nagging and strife between parent and child. When the youngster discovers there is no threat behind the millions of words he hears, he stops listening to them. The only messages he responds to are those reaching the peak of emotion, which means there's much screaming and yelling going on. The most important limitation of the verbal reprimands is that their user often has to resort to physical punishment in the end anyway.
So, he's recommending that we go straight to beating the kids up. Skip all verbal warnings.
Not inherently. There's a little bit of, like, you can de-escalate a situation. But if a kid's out of control and specifically trying to defy your authority, the only way to really reinforce that hierarchy, to enforce your authority, is to hit them.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
He goes back to talking about other things than spanking and how to hit kids. And then he says this was created expressly for the use of school teachers. And then goes on to describe how he abused other people's kids.
Okay.
Not even in school, by the way. This anecdote in this part of the chapter is some shoplifting teenagers came up to him, gave him some lip, and then he hurt them.
Oh my god.
He's very proud of this. What a fucking monster.
I mean, this is a sociopath.
This is chapter one of the first book.
Oh no.
So we have some rules for spanking and physical discipline.
Okay.
And the very first rule is you gotta make him cry. It is not necessary to beat the child into submission. Good, I guess. A little bit of pain goes a long way. However, the spanking should be of sufficient magnitude to cause the young child to cry genuinely.
I've dissociated. I'm sorry.
It's horrible.
It's so horrible.
He also believes the structure of this book is very weird. He's not a good writer, and the structure of it, so every chapter ends with a Q&A. I don't know where he's getting these cues. I think he just, like, had things he wanted to say and couldn't naturally fit them in because he's not a good writer. So anyway, one of the questions in this chapter is, how long do you think a child should be allowed to cry after being punished or spanked? Is there a limit? And Dobson says, yes, there is a limit. How long do you think a child should be allowed to cry, Brooke?
After being inflicted with pain,
mm-hmm.
a genuine pain, I would say as long as they fucking want to, because that hurts.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I would agree.
Mm-hmm.
That Dobson does not agree. Real crying, according to Dobson, quote, usually lasts 2 minutes or less, but may continue for up to 5. After that point, the child is merely complaining.
Okay, Dobson, let me tell you something about real crying. I'm a 44-year-old woman on Wellbutrin. It can last a lot longer than 2 minutes. And, like, based on what? It should be 2 minutes based on what?
He just pulls the most random shit out of his ass, states it authoritatively. He has 2 citations of this entire book, and both of them are for news articles. There's no scientific studies referenced, none of that shit. Just says stuff. And he has a PhD, so people just listen to him. He says it confidently.
Yeah. I mean, this is everything, though. Like, people are quoting things all the time. It's like, you have to look and see where this is coming from. This guy's literally just making this up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
There's a lot. And some of the later books that he writes, which I have started reading with help of many substances to cope, he says a lot of things about gender that are actually, like, now just mainstream beliefs. And I don't know if he's the one who said them first, but I do know that he's so influential that he's the reason that people that I know and love believe those things. They read him in his book first, and they're perpetuated through the church and lectures and just, like, quote-unquote common sense.
Yeah, and I feel like, correct me if I'm wrong, because the whole premise of this podcast is that I grew up sans religion. But, like, then people start to lump all of that in as, like, the Bible.
Yes.
Right? Like, when really it's, like, this dude in 1971 just making shit up.
And then they go back and find verses in the Bible, mostly out of context, sometimes in context, to justify these beliefs.
Right.
We're going to get into, he describes his beliefs as Judeo-Christian here.
Okay.
To give them an air of legitimacy, to say, like, these have been around forever, and only now are we starting to see society fall apart. First of all, that is not true. Your beliefs are not Judeo-Christian. They are evangelical Christian. They have very little to do with Judaism, actually. He's co-opting that to make it seem like they've been around for 5,000 years as opposed to since the 1920s. And they also haven't been around. The idea of the nuclear family, a man, a wife, and 2.5 kids, is new. It started becoming mainstream in America in the 1920s.
Yeah.
Before then, intergenerational living was much more common. Ideas of, like, more communal living with other parts of your family were common. And the idea of it being a patriarchy, although societally was that, you'd have a lot of matriarchy, a lot of, like, the old grandma lives upstairs who, like, actually controls the family with an iron fist. Like, that was much more common.
Right.
Not exclusively, but the nuclear family, as we understand it today, is a relatively recent invention. And Dobson's pretending like it's been around forever.
Wow.
More rules for spanking. You gotta do aftercare.
Oh, okay.
Quote, after the
emotional... that's true for...
Yeah. I
would agree with aftercare for spanking, but maybe in a different context.
Yeah. Right idea, wrong reasoning. He says, after the emotional ventilation, the child will often want to crumple to the breast of his parent, and he should be welcome with open, warm, loving arms. At that moment, you can talk heart to heart. You can tell how much you love him, how important he is to you. You can explain why he was punished and how he can avoid the difficulty next time. This kind of communication is not made possible by other disciplinary measures, such as standing the child in the corner or taking away his fire truck.
Yes, it is.
It is. And it kind of feels like emotional abuse to me.
Yeah. I spanked you because I loved you.
We're going to talk about operant conditioning in a little bit, but you're not teaching kids this behavior is bad. What you're teaching kids is, at any point, my parent can just hurt me.
Yeah, and then, as therapists, we'd like to let you know that that means that that is how that kid is going to view all relationships, right?
Yes.
Pain is love. Discipline is respect. This is how they're going to take this into their adult relationships. I noticed, like, I know it's the time, but, like, I know he's saying his, right? But, like, I'm specifically thinking about, like, women, people raised as women, and what they take forward into their lives with them, right? And that is alarming.
I'm so glad you picked up on that. This book is not about gender, but gender is screaming throughout this book, where he uses his and hers. He actually, Dobson created a version of the Bible specifically defaulting to he, his pronouns, because he got very tired of people defaulting to gender-neutral pronouns. Because just the default is man. The default is guy.
Right.
Clearly.
Right.
The last two rules for spanking.
Yes.
Only do it when they're purposefully challenging the hierarchy. Sometimes kids make mistakes. They're dumb. They're learning about the world. Don't hurt them if they accidentally spilled a cup of juice. That's not nice. But if they spilled a cup of juice to fuck you over, then you can hit them.
And in this context, how are you supposed to even know? If all actions by kids are defiant and premeditated.
This is that like discipline is not punishment thing comes in. He's trying to make a distinction here that doesn't really exist.
Right.
He just wants to hit kids.
Yeah, and he wants us all to join him.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The other thing is be sure to respect their sense of dignity.
You gotta be kidding me.
No. He's influenced a little bit by Adlerian psychology, which is all about how overcoming senses of inferiority. He really likes to point out Lee Harvey Oswald as a like description of having an overbearing mother and that's impacting your sense of self-worth. It's very weird. I don't understand it. Or I understand it and I just think it's dumb. But he says you should not spank a kid after they're 10 because then they care a lot about what their friends think about them. And if their friends see them getting spanked, that's going to hurt their feelings. And that's going to impact their sense of dignity and self-worth.
But didn't he accost a bunch of teenagers that were shoplifting?
Well, yeah, because they were being little shits. Well, those weren't his kids.
Oh, right. So you can hit other people's kids after 10. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
What age do you think Dobson thinks they should begin spanking kids?
What would Dobson thinks they should what?
Begin spanking kids.
Oh, God. I'm so scared about what the answer is. I don't even know if I can handle it. I would like to think, I mean, I'm thinking like a Dobson, mm-hmm. not like me. I would like to think hopefully the kid's like able to walk or run, like three?
Three? Okay. That's, you know, that's reasonable. One.
No, not one.
One.
Not one.
1 year old. You can start spanking your kids, according to Dobson. You should not spank any children, no. Let alone 1 year olds. But according to Dobson, one.
So a 1 year old often isn't even walking yet.
Or really talking.
And we're supposed to believe that they have thought through the disrespect that they are challenging the hierarchy at 1 year old. Mm-hmm. 12 months old.
I think he says 18 months. Which is such a big difference. I'm trying not to get sued for libel. I'm trying to accurately talk about how horrible his beliefs are. Yeah.
Okay, well that's going to haunt me.
So that's chapter one.
No, how? Oh, God.
The rest of it, chapter two, we're going to get into upper conditioning. It's a little involved. But the rest of it is just, it's equally as bad, but we don't have to get as involved with it because it's a lot of nonsense. I think this is good, a good understanding of how he's viewing the world and why he's making the terrible recommendations that he's making.
Yeah.
Chapter two is called The Miracle Tools. I've called this 34 pages to badly explain operant conditioning. Brooke, I apologize. This is Psych 101. I have to talk about operant conditioning and I have to explain it.
I hate it.
Okay.
All right. So I'm going to just mostly.
That's fine.
Just do it fast.
Get a cigarette. It's fine. Operant conditioning is a type of behavior modification through punishments and reinforcements. Because everything in psychology is unnecessarily complicated. There's like four options. Imagine like a 2x2 grid. You got positive and negative. Positive is adding something. Negative is taking something away. Then you got reinforcement and punishment. Reinforcement makes life good, and punishment makes life bad. So positive reinforcement is adding something that makes life good. This is like money for chores. Negative reinforcement is taking something bad away. So it's making life good by taking something away, such as time off a prison sentence for good behavior. That is negative reinforcement. Doesn't mean bad. It means taking away something bad. Positive punishment is adding something bad, like spanking. Negative punishment is taking something good away, like no electronics. Dobson doesn't talk about any of this.
But I want you to know you explained that better than like when I was studying for my licensing exam.
Thank you.
Than the book did. I appreciate it.
Because it's stupid and I have to force my brain to understand it. Yeah. Dobson only talks about the positive things, things you can add. You can give them a gold star if they do chores or you can spank them. He specifically says taking toys away is not a particularly effective way of parenting, of learning. So he badly explains operant conditioning. And as you were talking about, many studies have shown that reinforcement is more beneficial than punishment for long-term learning. Learning is complicated and it really depends on what we mean by learning. So like learning in a school system has different principles that go into it than like teaching a kid because you're their parent. But studies have shown that reinforcement, positive things, help children understand things better and more long-term. So the lessons that they learn through positive reinforcement are going to stick around. And punishment, especially positive punishment, like spanking, is associated with the highest levels of diminishing returns. A kid's going to, the first time you spank them, they're going to stop doing what they're doing because they're in pain and they've learned the lesson. The 100th time you spank them, maybe they're not going to do it at all. And this gets to part of the reason why spanking is such a terrible tool, because there's that level of extinction, it's super easy for parents then to escalate. You start by spanking them twice, and then they're defiant, so you spank them 5 times. And then maybe you stop spanking them on the butt, you spank them, I don't know, hit them somewhere else in the body. And all of a sudden, now you're just... I believe spanking is child abuse, but even in this logic, you've moved from spanking to just full-on child abuse really easily.
Right.
He once again unethically claims infallibility. This is always going to work. Part of the reason that this does not work, especially spanking, is operant conditioning generally is not the best view of how people learn. People are more complex than a robot, good, bad, input, output. So you don't always know what you're reinforcing. Grades, for instance. Grades don't reinforce learning. Grades reinforce that it's important to get good grades. And yeah, a way to get good grades is to learn the material. You could also get good grades by cheating.
Right.
Or by sleeping with a professor. Like, there's 1,001 ways to get good grades. What you're reinforcing is it's important to get good grades, not it's important to learn stuff.
Right.
If you're spanking a child and then giving them aftercare, maybe you're reinforcing this behavior is bad. Maybe you're reinforcing, hey, when you're in pain, you're going to get love afterwards. Maybe you're reinforcing the fact that they perceive you as a deeply unpredictable and potentially violent caretaker.
Yeah, and the goal is going to be don't get spanked.
Yeah.
Don't do the thing that got me spanked.
Don't get caught.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Unsurprisingly, he's also a simp for capitalism. The main, quote, the main reason for the overwhelming success of capitalism.
Oh, right.
Is that hard work and personal discipline are rewarded materially. The greatest weakness of socialism is the absence of reinforcement. Why should a man struggle to achieve if there is nothing special to be gained? It's the myth of meritocracy. I think it's also important to remember this first version was written in the 1970s, so there's a lot of like Cold War shit going on. Capitalism versus socialism was very salient, and also the ideas of capitalism connected to Christianity and atheism connected to socialism was going on. But you see the same logic now a lot from Republicans about like Social Security. You hear people who receive food stamps or SNAP benefits are lazy and they're taking away the reason for them to work. Despite the fact that over 70% of people who receive SNAP benefits are working full-time jobs every week.
Right.
Over half the people on disability are still working. Yeah. It doesn't take away the incentive.
And can we also just like inform people who may not know, you can't be a lazy person and be on food stamps. Trying to get food stamps.
Oh my God, yeah.
The process alone of trying to get on any of these benefits is so overwhelmingly difficult that's just not real.
Mm-hmm. And there's so many like bullshit requirements. A lot of people who I know who are living on disability cannot get married because if they get married to their partner, then all of a sudden they lose those disability benefits because theoretically they have someone who can care for them.
Right.
Even if the other person doesn't make that much money, even if they qualify for like unemployment or whatever, still disability gets taken away.
Yeah. The idea that there's all these people trying to game this incredibly complicated system is just like a complete fallacy.
And racist. Right?
And racist,
like
yeah.
The idea of welfare queens were popularized around this time, around Reagan's time. Which is the idea of black people getting unemployment and then not working, gaming the system in that way, which is largely untrue. Fun little break to this. He named his dog after Freud.
He named his dog Freud?
Well, he calls him Siggy.
Oh, of course he does.
And to train him, the treats that he gives this dog are chocolate chip cookies.
Dobson loves to hurt innocent little creatures. Listen, I'm a therapist, but I used to work at a vet's office. And just for anyone who doesn't know, dogs can't have chocolate.
No, they can't.
It will make them die.
No, they can't.
Or it'll make them cry for 2 minutes.
Yeah. Which will make my heart die for them.
Wait, really off subject, and you can cut this, but like, do you think he spanks the dogs?
No, I think he yells at the dogs.
No, that's not going to work. The dog is being willfully disrespectful.
we're gonna get into some tough shit for the rest of this chapter. Not that this has been particularly light and easy.
I hate this podcast.
So, operant conditioning doesn't always work. And he gives a case example of how it should work. And it's just some of the most horrific shit that I've heard. Talking about abuse of autistic children, basically. Oh. So, content warning for all of that. He says you can use operant conditioning to make a kid less autistic and, quote, more civilized.
Oh no.
It gets worse. So this one he's specifically talking about eye contact. People with autism on the autism spectrum tend not to like eye contact. It's fine. It's not, like, the worst thing in the world, but eye contact in a neurotypical sense is pretty normative and weird if someone's not looking in your eyes, and therefore is a problem that must be fixed. Dobson's solution through operant conditioning. This child, the autistic child, is placed in a small dark box which has one sliding wooden window. The therapist sits on the outside of the box, facing the child. As long as the child looks at the therapist, the window remains open. However, when his mind starts to wander and begins to gaze around, the panel falls, leaving him in the dark.
Just describe my face to the listeners.
Brooke's head is in her hands, mouth agape, a little bit flushed, a little bit red. It just, I have never seen you make this face before. Yeah.
Put your autistic child in a box, in a dark box, and then deny them access.
And again, children, their brains are still developing, and autism is a spectrum. There's a whole range of how it presents. Dobson, in this, it's also the 70s, so they think of autism as being like a pretty severe case, pretty debilitating in a lot of ways in a pretty ableist society. But in that case, then, a lot of those kids are also nonverbal.
Right.
So they're not able to tell you if they're scared or sad, or if they just start screaming, are they being defiant of your authority?
Right, like, autism isn't defiance.
No.
It's not disrespect.
I have a lot of notes that are in all caps, like, oh my god, you fucking deranged evil man. Yep. Oh, this is another quote of his to round out this part. Although I know of no child with severe autism who's been successfully transformed into a normal individual... The use of reinforcement therapy has brought some of these patients to a state of conversant civilized behavior.
No, it hasn't. And he made this up.
Mostly. This was a thing that people were doing in medicine at the time, because medicine has been evil and bad for a long time. So he didn't... This is a thing that some people were doing that he's reporting on.
Oh.
But you're not making kids less autistic. You're just teaching them how to mask. And masking is already an inherently uncomfortable thing for autistic people to do, let alone masking with the fear of being shut out from the world in a dark box.
Right.
Masking always has a little of anxiety, but now you're just making it intense fear on top of it.
Right.
That's the end of his part. I want to talk a little bit about the studies of spanking. Now that we've kind of gone through his ideas of learning, why he's spanking, why it's important according to him. Like I said, spanking has a really high levels of extinction. It can work in the moment, but has diminishing returns. Kids don't always understand cause and effect, especially one-year-olds. Study after study after study have shown that spanking can lead to increased aggression, antisocial behavior, physical injury, and mental health problems. One of the things that you're reinforcing when you're spanking kids is that violence is an acceptable outlet for aggression. Again, especially when kids aren't understanding the cause and effect, all they see is you are angry and you're hitting me, therefore I can be angry and hit people. Dr. Alan Kasdan, former president of the APA, said, you cannot punish out the behaviors that you do not want. You can't. That is, you just cannot punish out those behaviors. That's just not how it works. And because it does not work, parents often feel the need to escalate it. I found just one study that I was reading, and I'm a little bit of a research nerd, so I get into the details and the methods, and they had a sample size of about 50 kids who weren't spanked and 50 kids who were. And for this was a longitudinal study, so it follows kids for many, many years. And for that, that's a pretty decent sample size. But at the end, the sample size is about 50 and then about 25 kids who were spanked. And that happens, you know, there's natural attrition, especially in a long-term study. Sometimes people move, and this is pre-internet, so they might lose touch. But no, that's not why people dropped out. It's because they were just trying to study spanking, not quote-unquote physical abuse. They made that distinction there. And half of the children that they were followed who were spanked had to be removed from the study because they were also additionally physically abused.
Yeah.
Half. a full half of this. And even those who did not meet the criteria of other physical abuse showed the same outcomes: increased aggression, antisocial behavior, etc. Dobson says not to spank out of anger, but people will, even good parents. And you as an adult are not as aware as of a child's experience. What hurts you will hurt them 10 times more. What you think might be whatever is a lot to them. You have a lot of relationships as an adult. You theoretically have a community and support system around. When you're an infant, when you're a kid, your entire support system is your family, is your parents.
The person spanking.
Yeah. It feels important for me to end this chapter by noting the American Psychological Association says you should not spank your kids. And it is actually illegal in a number of countries to spank your kids. It is recognized as child abuse. This is a quote from the APA in 2019. The American Psychological Association recognizes that the scientific evidence demonstrates the negative effects of physical discipline of children by caregivers, and thereby recommends that caregivers use alternate forms of discipline that are associated with more positive outcomes for children. And for a scientific organization, that is as scathing as you can get.
Okay.
So that is chapters 1 and 2. That is an overview of his beliefs. The other chapters are kind of like one-off rants that I think are important to get into, make fun of. But this, I think, is the thesis of this book and the thesis of his work moving forward.
I'm just having this memory of when you came into my office and you were like, want to do this podcast with me? And I was like, yeah, that sounds so fun.
I've said from the start it's a deeply upsetting topic.
It is so upsetting. I feel like I'm being mentally spanked.
And not in a fun way.
No.
Well, kind of a fun way.
Yeah, it's kind of fun. Oh, Jake. Okay. Keep going.
Okay. The next ones are going to be a little bit easier. Well, a little bit quicker, at least. The next one's Discipline in the Classroom, which I have titled, It's Also Fun to Hit Other People's Kids. He splits it between primary education, K-12, and then college. K-12, he says it's important to have...
Wait, college?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He hates college kids. He says we need discipline in K-12, and the fact that we haven't is why college kids are so crazy now.
Okay. Oh, right, because it's the 70s.
It's the 70s, uh-huh. Yeah. There's some wild stuff in this one, too. For K-12, he has another parable example of how a teacher should interact with their kids. And it contrasts, these are my notes, my language, Pussy Bitch Beta Miss Peach and Girl Boss Mommy Mrs. Justice. Speaking of gender, though, I think that's very interesting. The, like, light, flowery, too easy is a miss, teacher. And the strict, good one is a missus, a married woman who knows how to discipline. Pussy-ass beta bitch Miss Peach is too lenient with her kids, and quickly the classroom falls out of disrepair. She wants to be their friend too much. Whereas girl boss mommy Miss Justice, she has a speech that she gives her class at the beginning of the year. It's going to be a good year, and I'm glad you're my students. I want you to know that each one of you is important to me. I hope you feel free to ask questions and enjoy learning in this class. I'll never laugh at you because it hurts to be laughed at. I want to be your friend, but there's one thing you should know. I have 1,000 ways to make you miserable. My job is important, and that's why I can't have 1 or 2 show-offs keeping me from doing my job. And he also recommends, somewhat tongue-in-cheek...
I kind of feel, like, attracted to her.
Oh, girl boss mommy, yeah. Mrs. Justice, someone giving me structure and rules to follow? Me? Oh, no.
Oh.
Dobson also says Mrs. Justice was effective because she follows his rule of don't smile to Thanksgiving.
What?
Don't smile to Thanksgiving. Don't let the kids have a good time. Don't be their friend until after Thanksgiving.
Oh.
Spend a couple months getting...
Don't smile until Thanksgiving as the teacher.
Yeah.
Okay.
Psycho. He goes on a long diatribe about a guy named A.S. Neil, who created a school without rules. There's a lot of, like, postmodernism taken to the nth degree. Like, do we need rules? Is that actually what kids need? Which, to be fair to Dobson, A.S. Neil's school does seem to just be a child rape facility. But that's not Dobson's critique. And I'm not really going to get into this because I don't want to defend this school, but, like... Dobson's critique, he's focusing on the wrong thing. It's not the lack of rules that's the problem.
I don't want to know anything about that.
Yeah. He also quotes Nietzsche here a little bit. Oh. And anytime a white dude is quoting Nietzsche to you, he's doing it wrong and is an asshole.
And also, you found him on Bumble.
Oh my God. You swipe right on Tinder by accident. I'm not going to explain his quote or why he's wrong about Nietzsche, because then I would be the white guy who's an asshole and doing it wrong. So we're going to move on from that too. But he thinks it's important for kids to have structure, any structure in the classroom, and discipline and hierarchy. College is where kids who reject authority go, especially public universities, God forbid. He hates political demonstrations, college students walking out, making demands of the administration. He says, quote, whether or not the students' demands were valid was of little consequence.
Of course.
Tone policing, all the good things.
So is he anti going to college?
No. In the same way that a lot of Republicans nowadays are not anti going to college, but they're anti quote unquote indoctrination in college.
Right.
That's where the Marxists and the Ben Shapiro will say, go to college, don't learn anything, but get the degree. Kind of in that vein.
Gotcha.
He talks less about the teachers trying to make your kids communists. He does a little bit. But also, this is the 70s. A lot of the things that we're seeing today in the political discourse are like this, but just evolved and matured and fermented in their own shit for 50 years. He has ideas on how to fix college for administrators.
Perfect. He has a lot of ideas.
He has a lot of ideas, stated very confidently. A 5,000 fee for anyone caught rioting or destroying property.
Did you say a $5,000
fee? $5,000
fee. In 1971?
Yeah.
I love that he just makes up these arbitrary things. Okay, what else?
That they should expel rioters. Anyone caught rioting. So the Vietnam War, the Korean War, these things were very unpopular. And it was a lot of youth and students who were leading the anti-war protests. A lot of it was occurring on college campuses. He calls a lot of those riots, some of them were actual riots, a lot of them are just protests that he didn't like. But he says, in the case of a campus riot, the National Guard troops or security police should surround the students. Any student remaining will be arrested, expelled, and prosecuted. This takes balls to write 1 year after the Kent State shooting.
Oh, yeah.
There were students who were engaged in anti-war protests. It was called a riot. I was not there. I couldn't tell you if it was or not. But the National Guard was called, opened fire, and killed 4 people in 13 seconds.
Oh, my God.
And that's... Dobson's not advocating outright for the murder of students, but everything up to shooting them, that's what he's advocating for.
This guy hates kids.
Just hates people.
He hates people, but he really hates the youth.
Yeah. He has a lot of strict penalties for outside agitators, which is another thing that we see in people criticizing protests nowadays. You saw a lot in 2020 with the George Floyd protests. He says that we should completely ban Antifa. He calls them the Students for a Democratic Society, but it's a lot of the same things. Any student who's too liberal, too out there, they must be a part of this thing.
Right, because again, they're going to challenge his power and his hierarchy.
He specifically says because they broke the social contract, which he defines as the agreement whereby citizens of a democracy forfeit the right to exploit other citizens. They cannot kill, cheat, or defame each other. Good thing Dobson has never defamed anybody or any group of people. Otherwise, he would have also broken the social contract, but he is good.
Yeah, he is good.
I think it's important at this point to point out the age of the founding fathers.
Oh, yeah.
James Monroe, 18. Aaron Burr, 20. Alexander Hamilton, the guy from the musical, 21. When he signed the Declaration of Independence.
There was an 18-year-old?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, these were not, like, grown-ass adults. I mean, some of them were. George Washington was kind of old. James Madison was 25, but, like...
25?
Yeah.
Why didn't I ever think of this?
Because we are shown the picture of them with the wigs and the dentures and right. When they're presidents. But, like, they're just a bunch of kids.
Yeah, college kids.
Yeah, quite literally.
Yeah.
And this is not... I mean, I have a lot of problems with the Founding Fathers generally. But, like, this is to say you take some 18-year-old seriously, just not the ones you disagree with, James Dobson.
Right.
We get our first Bible verse in this chapter as well. I don't think he quotes it or cites it, but it's 2 Timothy 3:2-6. And it's about how the end times, people are going to be jerks, and people are jerks, so therefore it must be the end times now.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And he ends, I wrote, that's Bible math.
Bible math.
He ends this chapter by telling kids don't be a hippie, and his argument is basically, because they're a bunch of losers, And honestly, this is the argument I respect the most. Like, there's not, like, pseudoscientific bullshit. It's basically just, like, they suck, their life sucks, they're a bunch of losers, don't be like them.
James Dobson is, like, fully in the on his lawn, yelling at the passersby. Like, you're a bunch of hippies.
Very that.
Oh, my God.
That's the end of that chapter.
What a crank.
This next one will go
who
through.
Who is he mad at?
Everyone who is questioning the authority of white patriarchy.
But who's he really mad at? Is it dad?
He doesn't have the best relationship with his dad. It got better. His dad was a pastor of the Church of the Nazarene.
Okay.
Which, if you remember, he believes, Dobson believes that he is now holy. And everything he says is inspired by God.
Oh, right, yeah.
Which is fun. I don't know who he's mad at. There is this, in evangelical culture, which comes out a lot in Dobson's writing, there's this, like, martyrdom complex where, like, the world is against us and we don't have any power. They're all turning to sin, despite the fact that every president has been a self-professed Christian.
Right.
Despite the fact that Dobson has been the spiritual advisor to 5 presidents. Clearly, he's the one who's aggrieved. He's the one who's not in power. The next chapter is Barrier to Learning, which is why some kids suck at school. It's oversimplistic, but it's not horrible. One is the late bloomer. Some kids just, like, need more time before they start preschool. You'd start at 6 or 7. It's very generous of him. Then he talks about the slow learner, which are people who are dumb but not stupid. That is not the language he uses, but I will not be using his language.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, I can guess.
Mm-hmm. We have IQ tests in here, baby. IQ tests, for the listener, are fake. Intelligence does not exist as one single variable. It's not normally distributed. The scores are fake and are also a clear sign of a eugenicist. When someone starts quoting IQ in less very specific context, they're probably a white supremacist and eugenicist.
Yeah.
There's a lot of cultural understandings that go into IQ tests as well, which is why there's IQ test disparities across the world, although intelligence actually isn't that distributed. He says slow learners have an IQ between 70 and 90, so they're just kind of dumb, and we need to be nice to them.
Oh.
So that's nice. This is where, again, he uses a lot of he, him stuff. So it's boys. He has a lot of empathy for adolescent boys and wants to protect their ego.
Right.
The last one is the underachiever. These are smart people who just don't care and don't try. I think he's describing ADHD a little bit in this.
Oh, interesting.
But he calls it a lack of self-discipline. And he critiques therapy in this chapter as well.
Oh, good. Let's hear it.
He talks about a person who he saw and therapy did not work for her. Quote, she beautifully illustrates the flaw in the modern philosophy of counseling, which dictates that the counselor must listen rather than lead.
Oh.
Which, yes.
So the counselor should also dare to discipline.
Yes.
Ow.
Dare to be directive.
Okay.
Also, yes, counselors, you should listen and not lead.
Right.
You can be directive. You can say, here's the homework we're doing, but therapy is not about imposing my values onto my clients.
Correct.
I cannot imagine what it must be like to be one of his clients, because he practiced therapy for a long time.
Well, I'm sure he only saw people that absolutely already believed all of this bullshit.
Maybe later on, but he was, like, on the board of hospitals and stuff.
Ugh.
That's that chapter. Like I said, pretty easy. This one is Discipline and Morality, the 1970s Culture War, Sexual Liberation, Sex Ed, and Feminism. That last part's my title for it. And so this, like I said, this book was written in 1971, or came out in 1971. So Stonewall had just happened, but the gay rights movement is only just really starting. So Dobson actually doesn't write a lot about gays. I don't think homosexuality is mentioned except, like, vaguely in passing here. Which is really interesting, because later in his life, Dobson will be known as the homophobe guy. He talks about how penicillin and the pill are bad because it gives people freedom to do sexual liberation. He quotes Nietzsche again, badly.
No. God. He's like the worst date you could ever have.
He's married. He's been married for a while.
Well, the pill is bad because it gives women choice.
Mm-hmm. Which undermines the hierarchy here.
Exactly.
I read the next book for this already, and there's some pretty explicit stuff about why that is a bad thing. Why sexual freedom is a bad thing. I'm very excited to...
We're going to need more backup for that.
To torture you with that, yes. He says, history reveals that societies begin to deteriorate when free love reaches a position of social acceptance. He does quote somebody here, an anthropologist named J.D. Unwin, who says every known culture in the world's history has followed the same sexual pattern. I was not able to find that much on Unwin. I did some research. He's not really talked about. He's not like a mainstream anthropologist, and his ideas are like basically discredited nowadays. Also, he did not research every known civilization. He researched like 20 of them.
Also, his name sounds like onion.
It does. It's not as good as rub one out, but... He has ideas of how you should talk to your kids about sex and when you should talk to kids about sex, about public sex ed.
Oh, I'm sure he's a big fan.
It's kind of.
Oh, really?
He says sex ed is okay to be taught in schools, but only if you teach the Christian morality that goes along with it.
Oh, okay.
So he does recommend that, quote, I would recommend that parents get their child a prolific pet so they learn about sex by watching animals fuck.
What?
I know.
Everybody gets a spanking and a rabbit.
That does unfortunately sound like a really good time. Going back to the martyrdom complex, he says the Supreme Court has prohibited prayer in public schools. This is actually still a common talking point in evangelical circles. That is not what they did. They're talking about a Supreme Court case called Engel v. Vitale, 1962, that said teachers cannot lead students in public prayer. Students cannot be forced to have prayer in schools. The school cannot lead prayer. Students are free to pray all they want. Students are free to read the Bible at school. There's a Bring Your Bible to School Day based on this false belief, and it's meant to, like, stick it to the man and show the world you're not afraid to be a Christian. There's a National Day of Prayer. There's a thing called See You at the Poll where...
Oh, yeah.
Where once a year or once a semester or whatever, kids will gather around the flagpole in prayers. Everyone else is coming in. Brooke, I did all of these things.
You saw You at the Poll?
I led Saw You at the Poll. I organized You at the Poll.
You did?
I sure did. Multiple years in high school. I brought my Bible to Bring Your Bible to School Day. I, at one point in drama club, led the... whoever wanted to was voluntary, but led everyone in prayer before rehearsal. And then I got yelled at to stop that because I was making people uncomfortable. Which, fair, valid. I cringe. No shame. I mean, a lot of shame for me, but no shame to other people there.
Do you ever have a See You at the Poll party now?
In a very different context.
Yeah.
Oh, I forgot to read these notes. I literally went through when I was in high school as a cringe evangelical. I led public prayer. I talked about See You at the Poll. Oh, I was so Christian. I was the head of the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, the Christian club in school.
Christian athlete?
Yeah. Okay. I was not an athlete. My little faggot ass is not an ath is not athletic. I can sing, I can dance, I can pot a beret, I can do a cute little eight step, but it was the only Christian club and it felt important, so I got to lead it. He shits on moral relativism. According to the precepts of moral relativism, which is still a boogeyman of evangelicals, premarital sexual experiences are proper if the participants have a meaningful relationship going for them.
Oh, really?
This gets so bitchy. Isn't that sweet? A couple can purify their sexual relationship if they convince themselves that they like each other.
Oh, sass.
Go off, Petty Queen. Hell yeah. Again, these are the moments that I like Dobson the most. It's when he's just being a bitch.
I like that Dobson voice you gave him there. Isn't that convenient? Go off, Petty Queen.
By not explicitly discouraging premarital sex, you implicitly endorse it, according to Dobson. So unless you're specifically telling kids don't fuck, you're telling them to fuck.
Okay.
Advocates for abstinence-only education, says humans have no instincts, only drives, reflexes, urges. Very, like, we need to develop our superego, very Freudian.
Uh-huh. Humans have no instincts?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It is my firm conviction that children should be taught ultimate loyalty to God. We should make it clear that a merciful God of love whom we serve is also a God of wrath. If we choose to defy his moral laws, we will suffer certain consequences. Being gay is an act against God, and therefore you deserve to have AIDS.
Oh.
Or Hurricane Katrina, or pick your natural disaster.
Right.
Also, because, like I said up top, these hierarchies reproduce on different scales, that's also why kids deserve punishment. Parents are parents of love, but also of wrath. Because God is a God of love, but also of wrath.
Scary.
Whew. We're getting into some very fun gender stuff. Just a hint. Just a taste of it.
Just a taste.
The natural sex appeal of girls, serves girls. As the primary source of bargaining power in the game of life.
Say it again.
The natural sex appeal of girls serves as the primary source of bargaining power in the game of life.
I'm gonna scream.
In exchange for feminine affection and love, a man accepts a girl as his lifetime responsibility, supplying her needs and caring for her welfare. Therefore, a girl who indiscriminately gives away her basis for exchange has little left with to bargain.
Why are you doing this to me?
This is the foundation of purity culture. This is where purity culture comes from, pretty directly from Dobson and his beliefs and his teaching. It's shit like this. When people say, like, every time you have sex, you're, like, chewing gum and no one wants to chew a ball of gum. It comes from stuff like this. The Andrew Tates of the world have beliefs similar to this.
I just don't understand how any woman could ever be like, yeah, that feels right for me. That's a good idea. Mm-hmm. This feels like a good thing to follow.
It provides certainty.
Yeah.
And I think that is why these beliefs are appealing to people. If this is just one hierarchy and that is how the world has to function, okay.
Right.
These are rules. These are structures. I can do that, or I can try to do that. It also has a lot of, like, in-group bias. Okay, we all know the truth. We're all doing things. And then everyone out there, they know that they're lying. They know that they're deceiving us. They know that they're trying to trick people. And therefore, not only are they disobeying God, they're actively being, like, little fuckers trying to mess with stuff. So we, as the in-group who know the truth, get to punish the out-group.
Ew.
Yeah. In the Q&A in the back, does poverty cause crime? No. The real villain of crime is a poverty of inner moral clarity. My note here is just, no, poverty causes crime, you ding-dong. He goes on for a bit about how juvenile courts are too lenient.
Oh,
famously yeah. are.
Famously too lenient, yeah.
Oh, the very last question of this chapter. I see now that I've been doing many things wrong with my children. Can I undo the harm once they are adolescents? No.
Oh, no?
No.
Oh, it's over.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Then you're just stuck with a kid that you're stuck with.
Oh, or just get rid of him. Send him to college.
The last full chapter is called Discipline Gone to Pot, which is why we need a war on drugs.
Discipline Gone to Pot?
Yeah.
It's fun.
Yeah, this is a pretty unremarkable chapter. It's all the things you would imagine. A lot of fear-mongering about heroin and a lot of gross use of talking about drug addicts. And if you've ever been through a DARE program, you know all of the talking points here.
Gross.
Fun old-timey drug names. There's a glossary in the back of, like, street names for drugs.
Yes.
What do you think a champ is?
Oh, this is fun. A champ is meth?
A drug abuser who won't reveal his supplier.
Oh.
Good on you, champ.
Good champ. Are these real?
I have no way of knowing.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Croaker.
Oh, that's someone who dies of a drug overdose.
You would think so. A doctor.
Oh, a doctor.
I don't know. Establishment.
The drug dealer.
Society. The man.
Oh.
Hey.
Hemp.
Yeah, weed. Pretty close. Yeah. Yeah. Huh? Manicure.
That's on your fingers. And you use your fingernails to do cocaine. Coke.
I like the logic. To break up marijuana for rolling into cigarettes.
Okay.
So it's so like using the hands.
Uh-huh.
Guess they didn't have the ancient technology of a grinder back in the day. Gay.
Oh, a gay person.
Yes.
Oh, great.
Yeah. I think that's our only reference to being gay in this whole book. Scarf a joint.
Scarf a joint.
Scarf a joint.
That's when you smoke the whole thing yourself and don't share it.
That's what I would think. And that's what I think it actually is. He says it's to swallow a marijuana cigarette.
That's not real.
That's not how weed works.
That is like, oh, dad.
Oh, creepy uncle. Oh,
that's not how weed works. No. That is to scarf a joint. No, it's to bogart a joint. That's what we used to call it in the 90s.
I like that. Does that mean just to do it all by yourself? Yeah. Wow, bogart a joint.
But I don't know why we called it that either, actually.
And then tea.
Tea's got to be marijuana.
Yes.
Yeah.
Why do you think it's marijuana?
Because it's like little...
Oh, like tea leaves.
Yeah, like tea leaves.
I'm learning here.
From an old.
This is the only chapter without a Q&A at the end.
Oh.
Which, neat.
Neat.
And the very last bit is a moment for mom. It's like a little, a couple pages. It's just a lot of Bible quotes, a lot of milquetoast advice. Reserve time for yourself. Don't struggle with things you can't change.
Oh, this is tips for mom?
Yeah. Before try she's... making a list.
Have you gotten into journaling?
Have you tried not being sad about it?
Have you tried some tea? Have you tried gathering together 50 cents going down to the establishment? Or talking to a croaker?
It ends, the last sentence in this book is, self-control, human kindness, respect, and peacefulness can again be manifested in America if we will dare to discipline in our homes and schools. And then my favorite part, the part that sends me in the last part of this book, ends with his CV.
Stop it.
It ends with like his, basically his resume.
Oh my God.
I am not kidding.
Like, instead of having actual citations, he just puts his resume?
Yes.
It literally is a CV. It's not even like a bio.
No.
Oh, no.
That shit sends me. It's so funny.
Wait. Professional experience. Teacher of sixth grade.
Oh, yeah. This man was a sixth grade teacher.
Oh, my God. Present responsibilities. James, this is embarrassing. Able to multitask and send faxes. Like,
proficient in Microsoft Office. James Dobson has never opened Excel a day in his life.
Okay, this is horrifying. I'm looking through this actual book now and I'm so scared.
That one I color-coded, all the red sticky notes are the most insane bullshit.
They are. Oh! Get this off me. Get this away from me.
So, okay. We are almost done.
Okay.
There's, I want to go through, he has two other versions of this. One released in the 90s, one released in the 2010s. And the reason that it feels very brief is because he doesn't change much. He just adds more. So between the 1970s and the 1990s, he just adds more things. The 34 pages to badly explain operant conditioning gets split up into two chapters and now 41 pages to badly explain operant conditioning. A lot of it is verbatim, bit by bit. The main thing that changes is the culture war thing. He goes on a different culture war binge. It's just called Discipline and Morality this time.
Mm.
It's very anti-gun or anti-shooting. This is before like the NRA really made gun owning like the political identity. So it talks about how school shootings are bad and whatnot. Very anti-quote safe sex.
Anti-safe sex?
Yes.
Okay.
Because you cannot have safe sex.
Oh, right, right.
There's no such thing. Which, again, right, but for the wrong reasons. Any sex technically has the risk of pregnancy and STIs if there is any genital contact or exchange of fluids. Sure. But you can have safer sex. He's saying it's just straight up, you just can't have any of it. The organization I represent, Focus on the Family, is concerned enough to speak out. We will do everything we can to save this generation of kids who now face the threat of death from the dreaded HIV. We are passive no longer.
Oh.
In 1992, Focus on the Family placed a full-page ad in USA Today to explain the health risks associated with this, with the myth of safe sex.
Oh, no.
This chapter, and the people who I have looked at book reviews of stuff, this is the chapter that people focus in on, because this is... We're in the 1970s, it's like insane bullshit and terrible, but it's like kind of measured. By this point, Focus on the Family has been founded. He is a celebrity, so it just goes off the rails.
Uh-huh.
A lot of AIDS fear-mongering in this chapter.
Helpful.
If you get HIV nowadays, it is not the end of the world. You can live a long, happy, fulfilled life. There's medication to treat it. You can reduce your viral load, which means you are undetectable. There's no detectable levels of HIV in your blood, which also means you're untransmittable. You cannot transmit the virus to other people. We have things like PrEP, which is a pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is a pill you can take before having sex with people. And it significantly reduces, see, this is me not making all or nothing claims, significantly reduces the amount, the risk that you could get of getting HIV, et cetera, et cetera. Don't listen to fear-mongering. Talks about the homosexual agenda.
Uh-oh.
The philosophy that governs several organizations, including the CDC, reflects the homosexual agenda, which includes recruitment of the young.
Oh, yeah.
So we're really seeing the, like, talking points of homophobia and misogyny get ramped up here. It was a really common belief back in the day, and you still see it with, like, some trans panic nowadays, that because gay people cannot reproduce, they need to recruit children. That's where at least a version of the myth of queer people being groomers comes from.
Yikes.
Yes, why is there so much resistance to abstinence-based programs? Because Planned Parenthood has other motives. Quote, the abortion business alone brings in an estimated $60 million annually.
The abortion business. Yeah.
Do you really believe that those who owe their livelihoods to killing unborn babies would prefer that adolescents abstain until marriage? Abstinence-only programs do not work. States with abstinence-only sex education have the highest rates of teen pregnancy. The whole reason that people are actually campaigning for safer sex and comprehensive sex ed is because that is actually how you lower teen pregnancy and reduce STIs and HIV and all that good stuff.
Abstinence programs create curiosity.
Mm-hmm. He plugs his own resources, including subscriptions for a kids' magazine.
Wait, James Dobson has a kids' magazine?
Focus on the Family is a media empire. They have all sorts of things at this point.
I forgot it would come through FOTF.
FOTF. He plugs it again for purity culture products. AIDS is only one avenue by which sickness and death befall those who play Russian roulette with God's moral law. My note in this one just says, eat shit and die. In the moment for Mom, he just goes on a long diatribe about how good Dare to Discipline 1970s version is.
Okay.
Even though people hate him for it. And he gets rid of the narrative section about drugs and just, like, here are the facts about it. Which the one in 2014 is identical to the one in the 90s.
Did you read all three of these?
I sure did. Also, thanks to my local library means I don't have to financially support this motherfucker.
Oh, yeah.
But when I got to compare and contrast the 90s and the 2010s version, I literally was able to go page by page and say they were exactly the same. There were some, like, spacing issues for some, but, like, literally they would end with the same word on the same page, so I was able to mostly scan that one. There's only very slight changes. Mostly that there are a lot fewer references to Focus on the Family.
Oh.
I realized, and I remembered, by 2014, James Dobson had left Focus on the Family. So he's just republishing this book under his own new stuff. Unchanged. Just exactly the same, just getting rid of a little bit Focus on the Family stuff.
Wow.
That is also why I feel okay to critique this book through a modern lens of psychology, because if he wanted to update anything, if he wanted to change anything, bitch had two chances to do it and did not do any of that.
Yeah.
So this book, we are now at the end of this podcast, this book has defined ideas of parenting for generations at this point. We are now finally starting to move into other ideas of parenting in a more mainstream way, but only now and only just starting to. I hate James Dobson.
I hate James Dobson.
What the fuck, man?
Oh, God, I hate him so much.
Brooke, thank you very much for letting me traumatize you. I can't wait to traumatize you again very soon.
Jake, as always, fuck you very much for having me do this with you.
I Hate James Dobson is a labor of love. Written, recorded, edited, and produced by me, Jake, with my amazing co-host, Brooke. Special thanks to Drew, Lindsay, DJ, Jack, and Brooks. Our theme music is by Moonbase, and the song is called Trendsetter. Thank you for enjoying our show.
Wait, I want to do one.
Okay, go for it.
Welcome to I Hate James Dobson. Who the hell is James Dobson?
That's good.